You're listening to an encore edition of Studio Tulsa recorded earlier this year. Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. One of the most influential civil rights figures of the first half of the 20th century is a person whose contributions to the later successes of the movement can't be overstated. Today, Walter White is known as the executive secretary of the NAACP, who led the strategy to confront equal rights and equal access to education through the federal courts. But as an assistant secretary through the first half of the century, he risked his life over and over again to write up real accounts of lynchings and other acts of racial violence throughout the South. White was African-American, but light-skinned with blonde hair and blue eyes. In Harlem, he was black and a leading figure in the Harlem Renaissance, but in the South, he passed for white, entering in conversations with Klansmen and the perpetrators of the violence. Here in Tulsa, after the 1921 race massacre, he was inadvertently deputized to patrol the streets of the burned-out Greenwood District and provided one of the first real accounts of the extent of the massacre. He led the ill-fated attempt to pass a federal anti-lynching law and created the NAACP Legal Defense Fund that set the stage for legal victories in the 40s and 50s and 60s. He was a key advisor to President Truman on the desegregation of the U.S. military. A.J. Baim is a contributor to the Wall Street Journal and the author of several books. His latest book is a biography of Walter White titled White Lies, The Double Life of Walter F. White and America's Darkest Secret. He joins us today on Studio Tulsa. A.J. Baim, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
I'm thrilled to be with you. Thank you, Rich.
Your new book, White Lies, details the life of Walter White, who was the head of the NAACP through a good part of the first half of the 20th century, and one of the most important figures in the quest for civil rights during that first half of the 20th century. But you know, the events of the second half of the century sort of eclipsed his important work. What attracted you to write a biography about him?
Well, Walter Francis White has appeared as a minor character in the last three books that I've written. And every time that I revisit his story, just in this sort of tangential research that I've been doing, I just found the deeper I got into his story, and it just struck me that it was unbelievable to me that people don't know who he is today. And the story itself is unbelievable. I mean, the first sentence of the book says that many readers will find in this book occurrences that they will feel impossible to believe, events that you think could never have happened in the United States of America.
You know, my knowledge of Walter White, it was really through Thurgood Marshall. You know, Marshall had a complex relationship with White. You know, he was sort of serving as eyes and ears for the NAACP, much as Walter White was much earlier in the century. And, you know, he often felt, you know, the NAACP was chronically lacking funds to properly fund defenses that Marshall was undertaking for the Legal Defense, Inc. So he was always had this sort of ambivalent relationship with White. He certainly did what White wanted him to do and did it very ably. But it's interesting, I learned a whole new side of Walter White's life in this book. What struck you most interesting about his own work before he became the person who basically ran the NAACP?
Well, Walter White came to New York. He was sort of plucked from obscurity by James Weldon Johnson. And, you know, listeners who have done any research or any reading in civil rights will know who James Weldon Johnson was. So Johnson plucked Walter from obscurity and brought him to New York in 1918. And Walter was what he called himself, the, quote, enigma of a black man trapped inside a white body. So he had been born into a black family. Both of his parents came from enslaved families. They were the last of the generation that could talk about the slave era from memory. And Walter went to a black school, black church, black university, but his skin was white, his hair was blonde, and his eyes were blue. And so when he began working in 1918 for the NAACP, this coincided with an explosion of racial violence in the South. And Walter took on a double life. He lived as an undercover investigator posing as a white man in the South and lived openly black in the 1920s in Harlem and became a major figure in the Harlem Renaissance. So sort of surprisingly, shockingly, his story illuminates both of those worlds.
Well, White first witnessed racial violence as a boy in Atlanta when a racial pogrom took place. I guess that's the best way to put it. It was We later called them race riots, and now we call them massacres. But this sounded more like a pogrom to me. And obviously that changed his viewpoint. How did that affect him?
He became literally maniacal in his quest for justice. So whenever a pogrom or a race riot or a massacre would happen, usually in the southern states, Walter would go undercover and he would get the facts. And he wrote about these stories in northern newspapers and magazines. And he was extraordinarily brave and you might say ambitious. And he would do things like barge into the governor's office and say, look, this crime happened. These are the names of the people who committed it. These are their addresses. These are their professions. And he, you know, every major incident of racial violence during the 1920s, he was there as an undercover investigator, including the 1921 Tulsa massacre. But what I gather from researching his life for years was the degree to which he was dedicated to trying to change America and try to open America's eyes to America's darkest secret, which is why the book is called The Double Life of Walter F. White and America's Darkest Secret.
Now, the first time he went to the South after starting to work for the NAACP, he went to a place called Estill Springs, Tennessee. And this is the first time, I think, where he really tried to pass as white in the South. Tell us about this particular story, because this is the first time he did it.
This is true. So it was, I believe it's either his 12th or 13th day working for the NAACP, and he would take the bus to work with his boss, and he cracked the newspaper, and he read this tiny little item about the killing of James McElhern and by a white mob. McElhern was Black. And he gets to the office and they sit down. There's this very vivid scene. They sit down in the office and they're talking about this. And it's important to, you know, for people to know that what the NAACP at that, what it was at the time. It was a very new organization. Very few people had heard of it. And it was made up of pretty much a white board of directors, people who had money to give to the cause, and Black civil rights leaders working together. So sort of Walter bridged these two worlds. But he considered himself Black and identified as Black. And they're sitting there talking about this horrible murder and torture, burning at the stake of James McElhern in Estill Springs, Tennessee. And Walter comes up with this idea. Why don't I go down there and get the facts? You know, I can pose as a white man and integrate myself into the community. And everybody in the room realizes how amazingly dangerous this would be. And Walter convinces them to let him go. And he wrote about this trip vividly. So I have all sorts of details to bring this story to life. And it's really terrifying.
He goes to Chattanooga, takes a little train to this little town. He poses as a traveling salesman and just starts talking to people in town and just engages them. He always had a vivacious style, which, you know, served him later as a salon home for the Harlem Renaissance. But in this case, he was able to talk to people. And pretty soon, just talking about all sorts of things, he got them to open up.
He did. And he did so very quickly. These people, was something he points out, these people were very happy to talk about what had happened and what they had personally done. It wasn't hard for him to root out the facts. Worth mentioning, he shows up at this little store right in the middle of the town. He claims to be a salesman for the Exalento Medicine Company. And he says that he's selling a brand of hair straightener, but he's all out of product. So he's got nothing to do in town, this traveling salesman, but sit around and chat. And he gets these people to talk about the killing of McElhern. And he gets the facts. Then he goes north, comes back to New York, and writes this article with all the details in a national magazine. And it caused a sensation. So that was just the beginning of his career as an undercover investigator.
And pretty soon, he takes a number of trips. You mentioned he came to Tulsa. The Tulsa story is amazing. He comes to Tulsa just a few days after the massacre. At this point, African-American residents are still being held at the McNulty Ballpark, where they're held under martial law, and they're being given passes to go back to work in their jobs if they have jobs, if people will vouch for them. And in the meantime, the local authorities here in Tulsa were deputizing any white person to patrol the streets to prevent what they said was a, quote, counterattack by African-Americans. And he goes and signs up.
He does. He goes, and you know what? In my research, I was able to find a place where he wrote down the dialogue, what was said. He's at City Hall. He's being deputized in this bizarre sort of service in which he has to declare his honor the United States Constitution, which he would have thought to be extraordinarily ironic. And a man in a U.S. Army uniform comes up to him with three other people behind him. And they stand there and they're looking at this stranger who is Walter. And Walter lights a cigarette. He's trying not to hide how afraid he is. He thinks he might about to be killed if his identity is discovered. And he has all the dialogue. "You say your name is White," this man says. And Walter says, "Yes." And the man says, "You say you're a newspaper man." Walter said, "Yes. Would you care to see my credentials?" "No, but I want to tell you something. There is an organization in the South that doesn't love N-word. It has branches everywhere. You needn't ask me the name. I can't tell you. But it has come back into existence to fight this blah, 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 expletive NAACP. And of course, this stranger was talking about the Ku Klux Klan.
Right. And he gets the story. And of course, his account of the race massacre was one of the first, well, really pretty authentic accounts that came out of Tulsa in those days, following the race massacre, beyond just the cursory newspaper stories. It was a very well-written, well-researched account of what happened. And this was not unique to Tulsa. He did it throughout the South. Anytime there was a lynching, anytime there was an uprising where black sharecroppers had unionized in Phillips County, Arkansas. Later, there was a series of lynchings in Aiken, South Carolina. And very soon after attending a number of these, and again, putting himself at great personal risk, he was able to sort of undo all the disinformation that surrounded racial violence in the South. I found that very interesting.
I think an important thing to point out, and yes, I mean, Walter conducted over 40 of these investigations with, major articles published in newspapers and magazines distributed nationally. He was able to find out who the killers were. He would barge into governor's offices with these memorandums and hand deliver these memorandums that I have. They were not hard to find in Walter's papers. And yet in all of these investigations, over 40 of them, no one was ever charged in any of these crimes, which is shocking. And really, I think readers, if they read the book, you'll really have a much better understanding about some of the things that are happening in our country today and why there's so much division and why racial violence continues to haunt us.
My guest today is A.J. Boehm. He's the author and journalist whose books include The Accidental President and Dewey Defeats Truman. It's two books about Harry S. Truman. Go Like Hell, which is the story of Ford and Ferrari in Le Mans, which later became the movie Ford versus Ferrari. And his new book is titled White Lies, The Double Life of Walter F. White and America's Darkest Secret. It's published by Mariner Books. He's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, one of the things I came away from the book was seeing these eerie parallels between today and the 1920s and 30s and the massive amount of misinformation and disinformation that was really coming out of these events of racial violence in the South. And, you know, Walter White would come in and interview people. He would get the story. He would get them in their own words. And then governments, local governments, mayors, police forces, law enforcement, governor's offices would just tell this utterly, completely different story.
The reason why that happened at the time, to me, is fascinating. And if you sort of compare it to why such things might be happening today, at the time, our country was in a much younger place. Media didn't really exist the way it did. There was no internet, no television. So news traveled via local newspaper, which meant whoever was running that newspaper could shape the ideas, opinions, and the knowledge of those local communities. Today, we have the same exact situation for the exact opposite direction. And that it's just my sort of pet theory that a lot of the misinformation problems we have in our country today is due to the death of local news and the fact that everybody is getting their news from one of two sources, and those two sources are free to say whatever they want. And that's why we have two different Americas, believing, truly believing, with immaculate belief systems, both are correct.
Now, as Walter White moves up through the NAACP, he and James Weldon Johnson began working seriously on getting an anti-lynching bill through Congress. He's writing books about it. He wrote a book that was lambasted or praised, depending on where you lived in the United States at the time, that sort of explained how lynching started. And that was a major focus of the NAACP. Got very close, passed the House, could never get through the Senate. Can you talk about his efforts to pass that federal anti-lynching bill and what it would have done? What would have changed if it had passed?
Well, it's an excellent question. Everything Walter did, as one person said about him, was, quote, without breaks. He was maniacal. When he set his mind to doing something, he was maniacal. And very early, actually all the way in 1918, the first year that he begins with the NAACP, he gets involved with this movement that the organization was very much behind to create a federal anti-lynching law. And the idea was that if he would go down to Estill Springs and he could investigate the killing of James McElhern, find out exactly who did it, and tell the world, but nothing could be done because the states and those local communities, they refused to enforce the laws. Everybody knew who killed James McElhern, but nobody ever got in trouble. So Walter believed that the federal government had the right, if a state, if local communities were not enforcing their law, that the federal government had a duty to uphold the Bill of Rights and the Constitution. And what this really happened, it set up for him as a very young age to go to Washington and to sit before Congress and testify and tell his story to these congressmen. And these scenes would turn into these bizarre conversations where congressmen were literally defending the act of lynching on the House floor, our own congressmen defending, or at times even arguing about the fact with each other whether Walter was white or black, right in front of him. They were extraordinary scenes.
As you continue the book and he moves up through the ranks of the NAACP, the assistant secretary for quite some time, and then finally becomes secretary. And in becoming secretary, leading the NAACP, he changes the focus of their focus of combating racism through criminal defense of racially motivated charges, working the courts to change the effectation of laws and regarding race, and lobbying for stronger laws. You write in the book that he really was influenced by Clarence Darrow, who was one of their first attorneys who handled a criminal defendant who the NAACP helped fund the defense. How did Clarence Darrow affect Walter White?
In a huge, huge way. So much so that Walter named his son after two different people, but Darrow is one of them. So in the middle of the book, there's this very intense case called the Sweet Trials, where a doctor in Detroit with his young family moves into a good neighborhood in Detroit that where mostly white people live. And the day he moves there, there's a riot out front of his house and a white person is killed. And Sweet is arrested and charged for murder. And he claims all he was doing was defending the home that he bought with his own money, which he had every right to do. So Walter gets himself involved. It's this sort of dramatic scene where he finds out about this case and the NAACP in Detroit is saying, please send Walter. We need Walter White. It's almost as if this crime fighter is some sort of superhero. And he goes to Detroit and he realizes that this doctor named Sweet is, pardon the language, screwed. There's no way a jury is going to let this guy off, whether he's innocent or guilty, just because of the color of his skin. So Walter goes out and he creates a cause celeb. He turns this thing into this national newspaper sensation, and he goes out and he gets the most famous lawyer who had ever lived to defend the Sweets, and that's Clarence Darrow. Darrow comes to Detroit, joins with Walter. They fight the case. They win the case. Historic trial. But at one point, Darrow is giving a speech. Walter convinces Clarence Darrow to come to Harlem and give a speech. So in this church in Harlem, he tells a huge crowd of African Americans, not a white face among them, except for himself, Clarence Darrow, except for maybe Walter. He says, look, all of this activism is going to be really tough. It's not getting you anywhere. What you need to do is fight with the vote. You need to empower the Black race in America through the voting booth. And that was sort of set the entire second half of this book and the entire second half of Walter White's life in motion. And it becomes a political force.
Yes. And that political force was changing the way African Americans thought, for those that could vote, how they cast their votes. Because since the end of slavery, African Americans always voted for the Republican. Republicans were the party of emancipation. They were the party of the 14th and 15th Amendment. And all of a sudden, Walter White is saying, take a look at the Democrats, not the Southern Democrats, but the Northern Democrats. They're building a new type of party. And he begins the move of the African-American vote from Republicans to Democrats. Why did he do that?
Well, he really saw, and again, I think it's really important. This is, you know, particularly younger readers are really surprised by this just because all that they know is sort of the alignment of our parties today. But at that time, yes, if you are African-American in this country, you voted Republican. You didn't even question. But by the time of the 1920s, Walter realizes very quickly that neither political party are doing anything for Black America. And so he realizes that instead of just voting for the Republicans, let's go out there and make demands of both parties and see who comes up with, you know, who meets us halfway. And he becomes the most important force in this historic realignment of Black voting power from the Republicans to the Democrats, meanwhile splitting the Democratic Party wide open, because the Democratic Party, what they called the Solid South, these were the Democrats of Alabama and Georgia, really what we think of as the Solid Republican Party today, they were the biggest racist demagogues in the country. And so in order to convince Black Americans to vote for the Democrats, Walter had a lot of work to do, and it took years to do. Through the alliances of Walter White and FDR, through Walter White's alliance with Eleanor Roosevelt, and ultimately, most importantly, with Harry Truman.
Well, what would you say Walter White's greatest accomplishment was?
It's funny that you asked that question, because it's one I haven't been asked before. And I think it's like the breadth of his work is what speaks to me, because you get through this, to me, you get through parts of this book and you can't believe that this guy can still be going, that he's that maniacal, that his quest for justice is burning so deeply inside him, but it never goes out. It lasts his entire life, all the way to the end, when he convinces Harry Truman to become the first president to address the NAACP, when he convinces Black America to align with the Democratic Party, when he convinces Thurgood Marshall to join the NAACP, launch this legal arm, which really had two main focuses at that time, which was voting rights, the same thing we're arguing about now, and education for Black people, which in many parts of the country didn't even exist.
One of the things that really struck me was, you know, here Walter White is becoming a relatively famous person, and yet, well after he becomes somewhat famous, he's still going into the South or Southern Indiana, which might as well be as part of the South as anywhere else, for its racial violence of the time, and he's still passing for white. Did he ever come really close to being discovered?
He did, and that's one of the things, like, if you talk about narrative tension, it's sort of a word we use to describe book writing where it just gets a little scarier as the pages go by. Every time Walter conducted one of his investigations, he was more famous than he was before. So every time he did so, there was more likelihood that he would have been discovered, his identity. And if he was investigating these, you know, there were literally tortures and killings and burnings at the stake in front of crowds larger than attended some Major League Baseball games. So Walter could only wonder what would happen to him if his identity was discovered. It was highly dangerous. And there was one investigation, I believe it was in Arkansas, where he realizes that his identity was discovered. And he literally has to sprint to the train station in a tiny town where there's only two trains a day. And he's waiting for this train to come and wondering if he's going to live to see it arrive. And he, when he buys his ticket, the guy behind the booth says, "Where are you going? There's a black man passing for white here in this town, and the guys are going to have some fun with him." So it was highly dangerous. Also, Thurgood Marshall came very, very close, as is seen later in the book, to being murdered, escaped by the skin of his teeth.
Yeah, it's very funny. One of his predecessors as secretary, he was the secretary when he joined, who was a white man. He goes to Austin, Texas to meet with the governor. When he comes out, he's beaten within an inch of his life.
His name was John Shalady, and he was the last white chief executive of the NAACP, to my knowledge. He was the chief executive of the organization when Walter arrived, but for a very short period of time, replaced by James Weldon Johnson, because John Shalady went to Texas because the NAACP, the local government in Austin, was trying to put the NAACP out of business. So Shalady goes down there and he's beaten, severely beaten, and he has a nervous breakdown and he actually disappears. And I was never able to find out even whatever happened to him after that. But the governor of Texas defended the beating and saying, if you're going to send activists down here, this is what's going to happen.
Well, it's a really amazing story. And, you know, the real tragedy of his life is Brown versus Board of Education, which the NAACP Legal Defense, Inc. Supported, is this decision is rendered by the Supreme Court. And literally months afterwards, he dies. Just on the verge of being, see the real civil rights era launch. It's sort of an interesting tragedy, I think, in a lot of ways.
I agree with you. At the same time, I think Walter saw more positive change with regards to race in America in the Truman administration in 1947, 1948, in terms of education rights, cases being won leading up to Brown versus Board of Education, fought by Thurgood Marshall, voting rights cases. He lived long enough to really see the positive effects of his work. And he wrote in his last book, which he just barely finished before his death, that he was proud to say that in his latest book, he didn't need to have a chapter about lynching because it wasn't such a big phenomenon in America anymore. And in between the time of his death and the time that book was published, it was called How Far the Promised Land, a young child named Emmett Till was murdered and tortured. And we all know that case. So it continues on.
AJ Bain, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Rich. I really appreciate it.
Journalist and author AJ Bain speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. His latest book is titled White Lies, The Double Life of Walter F. White and America's Darkest Secret. It's published by Mariner. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.